Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to Why Would You Tell Me That? A podcast by me, Dave Moore, and him, Neil Delamere. And we're here today to fact you into next week. Yes, give you as many as we can in the shortest space of time. And young Neil is the man leading today's episode. But before we get to him, let me just say that you should go to all of his gigs. He is neildelamere.com/gigs. I'm Dave Moore. I'm on Today FM. I've got a radio show there. You should go listen to that. And then in your spare time, you should listen to this podcast. You should review it on Apple. And you can review it by writing great podcast, 5 stars, and then reviewing anything else in the world. Anything. Don't care what it is. Go and review it. And then follow us both on social media. He's at Neil Delamere Comedy. I'm at Dave Today FM. And the show is at Why Would You Tell Me That? So, Neil, it's over to you.
Okay, well, I'm doing Vicar Street on May the 4th, as in May the 4th be with you. That's how you remember it. So now that you've opened that particular Pandora's box of plugging, I shall get that in there.
And hey, also, before you go any further, we both need to do a Wookiee impersonation.
Okay, you go first.
I don't have one, but okay. That was Neil, by the way. This is me.
That's just a man from Port Mariner falling down a well.
Trapped somewhere small. I can't get the gurgle.
Do you know, you said, okay, leave us 5-star reviews. You've opened that Pandora's box as well.
Dave, we got some.
Oh my God, we've got loads.
Oh, yes.
So there's just loads. Okay, here's one. Coming from a family who've consumed whole nut from the moment of conception, this is by far the most superior bar we've ever eaten. Perfect squares of edible nutty pleasure, especially suited to those 18 to 30, due to its stringent yet not overpowering flavor palate. Caution, excess ingestion may cause internal stress.
You see, anyone who goes on about flavor palates and is worried about overconsumption of chocolate is not aged between 18 and 30, I keep telling you.
Okay, we should mention, if this is your first time listening to the podcast, we did have a row over whether Cadbury's whole nut was suitable for people under 30. I think it is, he thinks it isn't, and it basically is the next civil war.
By the way, next time I go drive past your house, I'm going to post something in your letterbox. Okay. And it is going to be a giant slab of whole nut, which was sent to me by two metalheads, Gavin and Luke, who host a different podcast called That Sound Podcast, soon to be, I have a guest called Dave Morant. But anyway, it's about heavy metal and all that kind of stuff. And they sent me a birthday care package. In there was fancy paper that they heard me say on the radio before I used to collect.
Yeah.
They sent me a birthday card, it was very nice. They sent me a guitar pick, played by the band Gojira, one of my favorite French metal bands. They sent me that, was very, very sweet of them. And they sent me a giant bar of whole nut to give to Neil Delamere.
Well, I mean, I think when you say, I'm going to pop around your house and put something to the letterbox, I think it's a relief for all of us when it's not the dog shit that you did the last time.
Yeah, to be honest.
What a weird suitor he was in the early days of trying to get me to do this podcast.
You must be thankful it's not back in the days I was doing it up north.
Yeah, this used to be my favorite podcast. Now that I know Dave doesn't like chocolate with peanut butter, I've begun questioning everything. That's from Marilyn Flocks in the USA. A fine product, high thread count, great mileage, low in calories, and it keeps you warm when you're cold and cold when you're warm. I've three myself and its tires haven't gone bald yet, nor have I seen any evidence of excess drainage. Would recommend. 5 stars. So they are doing what we told them to do, reviewing random stuff and giving us 5 stars. I listened to the Cleopatra episode while taking an early morning shower. If I turned the volume up enough to hear Neil, then Dave was so loud that he threatened to wake up my wife in the bedroom and the cat that insists on watching me bathe meow constantly. I mean, that is a bit weird that the cat insists. How does it insist?
It's just clawing at the shower door.
Or does it just move its paw in a spiral like for you to do a turn? Okay, I turned down the volume where I couldn't understand either one of you to make the catch it up. Then an advertisement played and it was so loud compared to the episode that all the windows in the house exploded at once and my sleeping wife had a panic attack. 5 stars. That's from Marla Murphy.
There's absolutely no way that deserves 5 stars if that's what it did to you. But I will say, Neil, that is not your fault and that is not my fault. That is the fault of Cathal Minogue, who is our editor. Cathal, get the balance right. You can't just be using Neil's audio mic. You've got to get the balance right. Who needs to go up? Who needs to go down? Who needs a little bit of corrective EQ? Where are you putting the compression? When's the threshold kicking in? Cathal, these are basics. These are literally audio editing basics. And I expect you to work hard. And for goodness sake, it's got to be maximized so that it doesn't have an audio difference when the advertisement kicks in.
Oh, I mean, Dave, he kind of got a bit serious there for a second.
Did there for a second.
When it's about audio, I mean, this is the thing. Oh, he's all light and fluffy when it's about absolutely anything else, but audio and big bad Dave kicks
audio,
in.
Audio and whole nut, and I'm ratty as it gets.
Okay, this is the last one. US Capitol restrooms are amazing. As a longtime closeted gay man and Republican Senate candidate, I was nervous about moving away from my small town to become a puppet for lobbyists. I have a weak constitution in the best of times, so a good bathroom is key. Well, looky here. The fourth floor bathrooms in the East Wing are amazing. Me and my fellow Republicans simply love them. They even have a convenient round 3 in holes. What? In each stalls.
Careful
where we can
now.
Make small talk. They always say the only thing better than a good handshake is good eye contact. God bless. 5 stars.
Wow. Even the political bowels of the United States were got listeners. It's good to know.
Yeah, it is good to know. And I want to tell you, in the second half, we're going to talk to a man called Derek Guy. People will know him because he's the menswear guy who went absolutely viral. He's brilliant threads on menswear on Twitter. And he's going to explain to us in the second half, Dave, why the King of England might just help your trousers to stay up. You like that?
Yes, I
okay.
do.
I thought you would.
Yeah.
In part one, we're going to start in Greece. Okay. I meant to say to you, by the way, you did loads on one episode on the loudest sounds in the world.
And people
and checked it out. Do you know when you write decibels, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you write the dB of decibels?
Small d, big B.
Why is it a big B?
That's a good question. Well, deci is obviously 10 across many things. So I presume then Bells must be named after somebody and presumably that's his surname, no?
That's exactly it, Alexander Graham Bell.
Good guess for me.
Well done.
Yeah, I did not want Graham Bell.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I didn't know that at all.
And talking of Greek words, you know, you probably know this one. It's quite one of my favorite kind of, why is this word? Helicopter.
I certainly... I thought we did this on the podcast, but I definitely do it on radio as often as possible.
Okay,
but go on.
All right.
You tell everyone just in case they haven't heard it.
Helicopter, English speakers might think it's from two words, heli and copter, but it's actually more like helico and ter, P-T-E-R.
As in pterodactyl.
As in
meaning
pterodactyl.
Meaning wing and helico, helix.
Exactly. So Greek helix meaning spiral and pteron meaning wing. So spiral wing. Okay.
Now, so good.
That leads us into Greece. If you want to go on a quiet holiday, Dave, you should go to Greece.
Okay, right? Why?
You, your wife, your sons, your daughters, and even Lorna, the greyhound, well, the lurcher when she was with us. I want you to go to Mount Athos, and I think you'll have a lovely holiday.
Why?
Have you ever heard of Mount Athos? It's called the Holy Mountain. It's on a peninsula in northern Greece, right? And the mountain, it takes up most of the peninsula, I suppose.
Right.
It's an autonomous zone within Greece. It has 20 or so monasteries on it, and you will be the only one let in of all the people and dogs I've just mentioned. No women allowed.
No, I was going to say, no women, no children, no dogs.
No women, no younger men. No, sorry, right. No boys. No female animals.
Oh.
Yes. There is one exception to this.
Okay.
Cats. They've just kind of overlooked cats because of their mousing abilities.
Ah, very useful. As we heard in the episode about sharks last week, cats are psychopaths and they kill but only eat a tiny percentage. They're literally going to just, they love murder. That's what cats love. Late night murder.
Just killing for the crack.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they do.
So they're I could bring my Uncle Barry.
Yes.
But I couldn't bring my Auntie Sheila.
Exactly. Are they real people?
No.
Okay.
Actually, I do have an Uncle Barry, but I wasn't thinking of him. But now that you say it, yeah. Hiya, Barry.
That is the single most Dave thing I've ever heard. I have an Uncle Barry. Is he a real person? No. Well, he is. But it's not the Uncle Barry that I was thinking of.
No, I had projected to a different uncle, a made-up uncle in my head, instead of the real uncle I have, who I absolutely could have thought of.
So you made up an uncle, but still called him the name of an uncle you actually have.
Yeah.
How was anybody expected to understand anything you say at any moment in time?
I don't know. And in my head as well, he had a beard, which my Uncle Barry has. And he was about in his 40s, younger than I am now. But the man I had pictured was very similar to Barry, but it wasn't Barry.
I'd love to play Guess Who with you. Just, does the person have a hat? Yes. Do they
but
have a hat?
But also, no.
They do have a hat, but not the hat. It's a hat that's so small to the naked eye, so I don't know whether to put the picture up or put the picture down.
They do have a hat, but not the one I was thinking of.
Can you imagine if your wife was the one who asked you to marry you? Will you marry me? Yes. Is that a yes to the question I just asked you? Sorry, it was a yes to a different question asked by you, but yes, I will marry you. You're a psychopath. You should be a cat.
He's not wrong.
But I think it's a really interesting place, right? 20 monasteries, 330 square kilometres. So it's a big old chunk of land that women aren't allowed in. It's a World Heritage Site. The monasteries are of the monastic community. They're storopegic. I mean, aren't we all?
Yeah.
They're exempt from the authority of the local bishop and only report to the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople.
Jesus. Now, hang on a second. I'm going to go back.
No,
so, all right.
Patriarch of Constantinople.
Someone very different. So I presume you say, first of all, that I'm going to have a very nice holiday because I now am free of all, you know, responsibilities, children, dog.
Yeah.
It's not that all 20 monasteries have taken a vow of silence and it's a super quiet place that way.
No. It's just quiet because you're on your own. That's why.
Right.
Yeah. And there's lots to see and do there. So I ended up watching a video of a Lebanese monk, right? I mistyped something and it was a Lebanese thing. And he lives there, and most of the people there they're Orthodox monasteries, okay? And most of them are Greek monasteries, but there's Russian monasteries and Serbian monasteries and Romanian monasteries. And the Lebanese dude was on, he was telling the story. So the legend has it, by the way, you can see the gifts that the three wise men gave to Jesus. They're there.
Ah, stop.
It's been famous for 1,000 years as a place of pilgrimage. And the story, the legend is that the Virgin Mary was swept off course, apparently, landed there, and she alone represents her gender on the Holy Mountain.
Swept off course? From where? From whence? To whence? Where was she going?
She was booze cruise to Liverpool. She was buying vodka.
From Northern Greece.
Yeah, from Northern Greece. Oi, oi! And she was swept off course to Greece. And she's like, I've got chills, they're multiplying. Oh, wrong spelling.
And by the way, it is wrong spelling. It's lesbian MILF, not Lebanese monk.
I am so happy about how happy that made you. I mean, I've never seen a man as happy with his own joke as this.
It just occurred to me just there. I was like, that's a great joke. I'll throw that in. See how
I met a man last night. Who in the audience, and his name was Noel. And I said, what do you do, Noel? And he said, fencing. And then I presumed to give him, rather than the agricultural fencing. And Noel did a whoosh, 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 and it was a Z like Zorro, but actually it wasn't a Z. It was an N for Noel on its side. And I laughed for about 5 minutes in front of 300 people who looked at me going, it was all right, but it wasn't as good as what you gave us. And basically, you've done the same thing here.
Yeah, I have, I have, I have. Yeah, so I do like your sideways end, I have to say.
Yeah, I thought you would. But yeah, this monastic community bans women and female animals from entry in what is called an avaton. And this is intended, this is what it says now. I've done a bit of research on this, but this is direct from the Wikipedia page, and then I kind of went down the rabbit hole. Okay. But I thought this was weird. This was intended to make living in celibacy easier for men who've chosen to do so, which might explain the absence of women, but doesn't really explain the absence of female animals. I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a lot of issues there.
But yeah, and when Greece joined the EU, there were parts of treaties that suggest that, listen, you have to leave Mount Athos alone because it's this very specific area. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And they were afraid, particularly when the Schengen Agreement came in, the monastic community there were afraid that that might affect that ban and lobbied against that. So
right. Now, can I put an avaton in my house? Can I enact an avaton here, which means that the wife, children, and any animals are not allowed, I don't know, for example, upstairs.
Upstairs, in the room where you watch television.
Something like that. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Are you prepared to be a monk? And when I say a monk, I mean an actual monastic dweller and not a Dublin gangland criminal.
Neither. I don't want to be either of those things.
You can't have all the good without
consequences. That's fair.
Let me go on to things that, we'll continue in the vein of things that are banned, right? We're jumping all around the place here, but, you know, it is religious and it is something that's banned. Did you know that Mary Poppins is banned in Germany on a Good Friday?
Banned in Germany on a good Mary Poppins.
Yeah. That umbrella wielding.
Now, stop. That is unnecessary. Mary Poppins is a wonderful children's story.
I just thought, what is the roughest word I can use to describe that?
Julie Andrews is a dote. Yeah. And then the modern day retelling with Emily Blunt is fantastic.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
Neither of whom are umbrella wielding whatever you said.
Yeah. Why is Mary Poppins, who is a sweet children's staple, a staple of our childhood in its original sense, because she used to be repeated, but why is she banned, do you think, on Good Friday?
Because as much as I like the movie and the story and both retellings, Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious is a little annoying, and they figured it distracted Catholics from something on Good Friday.
It's like one of those really long German words like Schadenfreude.
It
actually means something. It means annoyance to someone who wields an umbrella incorrectly in German.
On Fridays.
Good Friday is considered a quiet holiday in Germany, which means activities which contradict the character of the day are banned by law. Still tag.
So that would mean you can't do loud things.
Yeah, it's according to constitutional law on the protection of Sundays and public holidays, there are certain activities that are banned if they contradict the character of the day. So Berlin's Berlin. So the laws are kind of handled fairly loosely. But in many states in Germany, dancing isn't allowed during the day.
Specifically on Good Friday?
On Good Friday. Restaurants, markets, sporting events, circus performances, folk festivals, entertainment events.
Listen, you can have like a massive, like David Guetta can have a rave in a forest, but you can't have a folk festival.
No folk festival.
Those guys with the mandolins and twirling a baton with a little string on it.
I think it's a gateway drug. You take your polka, they come up to you with an accordion, and your first go of the accordion is free, and then suddenly you're injecting heroin into your eyeballs, rubbing your ball sack and fentanyl, and you know, that's no way.
Wow, that did escalate quickly.
That is no way to celebrate the crucifixion.
I will tell you that I did go to Germany. Mm. Not on Good Friday, but on a Friday and a Sunday in May of 2023 to see Metallica.
Okay.
And on the Friday in Hamburg, everything was open. It was a wild place and so much crack, whatever. On the Sunday, everything was closed. Now, I mean, everything was closed. The only thing that was open is they have a kind of a version of the red light district of Amsterdam in Hamburg. That seems to have special dispensation.
The Reaper ban, yeah.
Yeah, Reaper ban. That is open and kind of like... And sorry, when I say red district, I just mean like the shops are open and the restaurants are open, the bars are open and the clothes shops are open. It's not like you're walking down and there's, you know, ladies of the night, you know, standing around the place. They don't come out till much later, apparently. But yeah, but everything, like, I mean, super, like, Lidl was closed. Like, it wasn't like, this was a standard Sunday. So they do really shut down on the still tax.
Absolutely, yeah. So law abiders should avoid broadcasting certain films on Good Friday. And this list grows year on year. The FSK is the German motion picture rating system. And it's been around since about 1980. And it oversees a catalogue of films deemed unsuitable for holiday viewing.
Wow.
So not too many are added annually. Like in the 50s and 60s, more than half of all films were on the banned list, right? But in 2016, only 1% of the requested films could not be watched according to FSK. So you want to know the restricted ones?
Go on.
RoboCop, No Mary Poppins, The Life of Brian, Mad Max, Heidi in the Mountains. Heidi in the Mountains.
They really have it. Like Mad Max versus Heidi in the Mountains. Yeah. Like they're not the same.
Somebody's watching too many films and getting them mixed up. And then Heidi, she takes all the petrol out of a car and races Mel Gibson down the hill, and whoever wins gets Muesli. I think that's what it is. Tina Turner comes out of a cuckoo clock and says, two men enter, one man leaves, and then on the hour, every hour is a man with milk. I think that's...
Mad Heidi sounds like the mashup movie we actually need.
I 100% would watch Mad Heidi. But yeah, they're thought to kind of contradict the serious character of public holidays, including...
Okay. I mean, it makes sense in a general kind of conceptual way, I think.
Yeah.
However, I think cherry picking the movies that can or cannot be watched seems a little archaic.
I would make it, yeah, I'd make the point that it is very archaic because that's just the cinema. So if you have Netflix or Amazon or television, they can show whatever they want. Satire, horror, action programming, anything. Last but by no means least, I thought in the most obvious science proof in the history of all science proofs, you're watching a match. You're watching a match.
Will I be watching Manchester United against Liverpool, taking 2 points off Jurgen Klopp's pathetic round the country little farewell tour?
Taking 2 points. You were at home. What are you talking about taking 2 points?
Have you seen Manchester United play football? We are taking 2 points off you.
I haven't seen you play football, and I didn't see you play football yesterday. It was awful. Awful. If you don't watch football, Liverpool played Manchester United. I had another bet with Dave. Fully convinced, actually, that I was going to lose 3 bets in a row to this avaricious, greedy Manchester United supporting scumbucket who put dog feces and hold nut through the door, and I have to guess which. He blindfolds me, and in a horrible game of Russian roulette, I'm either very happy or very sad. So they played yesterday, and Liverpool absolutely battered them for the first half, were completely wasteful, and then I knew you were going to score. I just knew.
So did I. It was a thing of pure beauty. And to see Jurgen Klopp and his fake turkey teeth just freaking out at the end, leaving Old Trafford empty-handed for the last time on his bullshit farewell tour where he'll win nothing, he'll come third in the league, lose the Europa League final, and he'll walk away with the Carabao Cup. Auf Wiedersehen, Jurgen! Auf Wiedersehen!
Couldn't disagree more. First of all, Jurgen is an absolute legend. And second of all, he got those teeth. He's an extra. Well, I say extra, but it's actually more of a real action part. Eventually, it's going to be written up in Mad Heidi the Second.
he's like your man Jaws in the Bond movie.
He needs a weapon. So if you're watching a match, I'm going to extrapolate out from the actual results of this scientific survey. Do you shout at the referee? Now, you're a coach, so you have to probably set a good example, but do you?
I shout at the football players while watching the thing. I don't know. I don't really shout at the referees. Again, you're probably right. It genuinely is probably from...
You were setting a good example.
From my example that I have to set, yeah.
Well, there's new evidence that says it can pay to scream at referees in sports stadiums.
Oh!
The evidence appears in the study Verbal Aggression Against Major League Baseball Umpires Affects Their Decision-Making.
No way!
By these three people, Joel Guret, Caroline Blay, and Daniel Fisse, I think, at the University of Quebec in Canada. And they published it in the journal Psychological Science. So they all probed data from 10 years of Major League Professional Baseball games. And the, if you don't know baseball, I suggest you look up Rounders.
And or baseball, or whichever baseball. You want.
Look, but I wanted to have a, I wanted to have a go at it. Come on. It's not a real game. It's basically Rounders. These games, I stress, unfold in an ecological environment where excessive criticism is rampant, which is really... I like the fact that they've used science talk to talk the madness that happens at a sporting event. So they detected what they call a two-sided benefit of resorting to verbal abuse.
Go on.
So, should I shout at him? Well, there's two sides.
Science says.
Yeah, it's two sides. After being severely criticized, home plate umpires were less likely to call strikes to batters from the complaining team and more prone to call strikes to batters on the opposing team.
Right, okay.
So basically, under certain conditions, verbal aggression may offer an advantage to complainants. So can you get in the heads, ref? In baseball, certainly, it suggests that they can.
Well,
and who would suggest that any sports are any better than that? So,
yeah, well, I would imagine that the research hasn't been done. But, I mean, anecdotally, you can certainly remember, you know, in the 90s, Manchester United being the successful team they were at that point, Neil, as sore as it was for you, I'm sure. You remember the images of, you know, Roy Keane, Yapstam, you know, Nemanja Vidić, whoever, running up to the referee, eyes wide, mouths foaming or whatever. And then the fact that that over time, that kind of approach would lead to referees giving favourable decisions to Manchester United or indeed Arsenal or indeed Leeds or indeed whoever did it.
Martin Keown would do it as well, yeah.
Martin Keown or Arsenal, exactly. And look, even the managers on the sideline, you know, would be intimidating characters. And you see it even now after games when they don't agree, they walk over and they're finger pointing and shouting and roaring. It's obviously a little bit tamer now with 7 million cameras pointed at them and all the rest, but
I do like how unbelievably polite rugby players are to the referee. I think that's what should
so
happen
good.
In football. But like you have Roy Keane in those days, and as you say, Jamie Vardy, they're all in their face, and then you hear the rugby mic'd up. Excuse me, stand back a little bit, please. I'm so sorry, referee. Like they might as well curtsy and they might as well bow it. Now, you used a bad word and you looked at your opponent in a way that I could describe as ungentlemanly.
But you know what? It must be. The fact that rugby is so immensely physical
and aggressive,
that the aggression exists in such a strong and you know visceral way that when you turn around then and do something ungentlemanly, it's like, oh dear God, why have you done that? I'm terribly sorry. I realize I just caused an actual car crash worth of impact to the other guy in a completely legal move.
Yes.
But then when I, you know, gently put my finger in his ear, that is what I'm being called up on.
Absolutely. And apparently we have to meet on Wimbledon Common at dawn. I've chosen him as my second and he demands satisfaction. It is that level of, and I was always surprised by how football, I mean, it is a bit more visceral. I went to a championship match years ago and it was like QPR. No, it was Blackburn versus Forest when both of them were in the championship. And a certain, people will be able to figure this out, a certain player, actually I'm not going to say what nationality was, a certain player who you will know, I was right on the touchline, came to get a throw in. And all the it was in Forest, and all the Forest fans shouted at him, and I thought he would rise above it.
Yeah.
He just turned to some young lad and went, "I fucked your mum," and then took the throw in. It was absolutely quality.
Oh, that's so good. My favourite story is as a Bose fan, Bohemians are a football team in Dublin. And as a Bose fan, in the noughties when the League of Ireland was very, very high standard, professional, fully professional league, I was a Bose fan in the glory days and they'd be in Europe and but they'd also be in the local cup competitions. So what would happen is high-flying Bose who might be playing Hertha Berlin, you know, on a Wednesday or Thursday, whatever, in the Europa League, would then on the Sunday would be playing against, you know, Scaries United, who would be a local amateur club, but who've just gotten to a certain round in the cup or whatever. It was one of these teams. It probably wasn't Scaries. I can't remember. It could have been Lusk United. It could have been anybody, but it was a local amateur team, and they had gotten to play this high flying Bose team. And I'm trying to remember exactly who it was now. I think, what was his name? Robbie Doyle, I think his name was, right? So he was a Bose player, a tricky winger, but very stylish, really cool haircut, perhaps possibly a shaved line in his eyebrow.
Ooh, okay.
Mid-noughties, certainly outside of football, would definitely have had one earring. You know, and they were well paid, so he would have had a flashy car, nice clothes, all these things that would have been going on. So at one point, he had, you know, done his tricksy little tricks and had bamboozled a fullback a couple of times, whatever, and was probably feeling a little bit overconfident. And he had then done some kind of a rainbow flick over, and the fans of, let's call them Scaries, went absolutely ballistic at him. And the stand was divided in two, and it was all the Scaries fans on one side. I'm saying Scaries, as I said, could be anybody. All the lower clubs fans there, and all the Bows fans on this side of the Jody stand. But I was happened to be very close to the middle. And so a fella ran down, spitting rage. Like, there was rage coming out of every pore of his head at this fella, Robbie Doyle. And he got his program, and he threw it as hard as he could at Robbie as Robbie went to take a throw in. But given that it's a magazine, but it just kind of caught in the air and kind of flipped up and down and landed down beside Robbie, didn't cause any harm whatsoever. So again, I assumed Robbie would rise above it and would just take the throw in. He turned around, picked up the program, turned back around to the fella and motioned to him, "Do you have a pen? As in, I'll sign it for you." Your man's head nearly exploded. You know the way the paramedics come over when there's a medical emergency? He had to be like stretchered out of the place. He was literally apoplectic with rage.
Who will I make it out to? Man with purple head? Is this is man with purple head?
Throbbing vein in the side of the temple? Is that you?
Is it needs four stents? Is that your surname or your first name? That's absolutely quality. Listen, we are going to talk to Derek Guy, the Mensberg guy, in part two about why the King of England might help you hold your trousers up. Are you curious at all?
I cannot wait.
Excellent. That's in part two.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to part two of Why Would You Tell Me That Now? We are delighted to be joined by menswear expert, a man who's written for the New York Times, the Financial Times, the Washington Post, amongst others, and you'll know his brilliant threads from Twitter. His name's Derek Guy. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today, Derek.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, all I said to Dave in the first half, this is all I said to him, is that you would explain why the King of England helps his trousers stay up, right? So I know it's a little bit cryptic, but we're in the realms of belts and braces here. And it's fair enough to say that you would favour suspenders over the belt, not for workwear or sportswear. And we're calling suspenders and braces the same thing.
Yes, we're calling suspenders and braces the same thing. I will honestly admit I rarely wear suspenders, but I recognize that they are the superior pant support system, essentially.
I mean, if something was sold to me as a pant support system, I think I'd definitely be in for it. But why do you think that?
Well, one thing to note is that suspenders is basically how Western men held their trousers up for the longest time. And they're superior because they essentially hold your pants up from your shoulders, whereas a belt holds it, you know, essentially in the middle of your body. And the only way that a belt works is if it kind of like cinches on your body like a tourniquet. And the nice thing about suspenders is that they hold your pants up from the shoulders, and they allow the waist of your trousers to not squeeze as much. So when you're sitting down after you've had a full meal, you know, as you're moving around, your pants are essentially always in the same place, whereas belts can kind of be uncomfortable depending if, you know, if you've gained a little bit of weight, if you're sitting down, they slip down throughout the day, whereas suspenders are always, you know, they hold your pants in the same place all the time. But over time, suspenders kind of fell out of fashion, and now we're essentially stuck with belts.
So you're kind of wearing your trousers, they kind of float around you almost, rather than being, you know, tied to you, like some sort of, you know, when someone's climbing a telephone pole, Dave, you know, and they have to tie themselves. That's the kind of visual that we're going for here.
Before we get on to the King of England and why that's relevant to this conversation, I just want to ask Derek one thing, admit one thing to Derek, which is there is another solution. There is a third option. And that is what I go for, okay. Derek, which is slightly overweight and we call them tracksuit bottoms, but you call them sweatpants. And those things have a drawstring. Right. It's not a belt. It's not suspenders, but they are the most comfortable thing in the world. And occasionally I can delve into the world of shorts from about March until November. And everything's got a drawstring. Everything's elasticated. And I think this might be an option yet to be explored by gentlemen like yourself who are obviously, you know, dressing far better than I am. But it's comfort 101.
No, I agree. That is actually the best option. Although there are two types of systems there. You either have the drawstring, which is just essentially it's a built-in belt, essentially. Or as what you noted, you have an elasticated system that may or may not be finished with the drawstring. And that is certainly the most comfortable. But, you know, style-wise, I don't think there's anything wrong with them. Certainly, they work very well on shorts.
You're a polite man, Derek, and I appreciate that about you. Thank you.
Yeah, he's a very polite man. It does indicate that you've given up on life, Dave.
Yes, I would say that.
I am
certainly from a style
behalf.
Point of view. Yes, yeah, I have. Yes,
Dave, Derek, don't worry. Dave isn't precious when he comes to this. He freely admits that he dresses like a toddler, to use his own words, essentially sweatshirts and shorts, no matter the weather.
Pretty much all the time, yeah.
It's comfortable and stylish. It's got approval from me.
Well, you're 50%
right. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so if the superior pant support system, PM, is the braces, which my father will be delighted to know because he's 88 and I've never seen him wear a belt, why have suspenders, why have braces fallen out of fashion?
So in the early, late 19th century, early 20th century, belts were still mostly limited to workwear and sportswear. And men who wore tailored trousers, essentially for suits, sport coats and such, wore suspenders. But a man known as the Duke of Windsor had a tremendous influence on men's fashion. Actually, for much of the 20th century, you can track a lot of changes in men's fashion down to the Duke of Windsor. And the Duke of Windsor, I mean, he wasn't novel in the regard that men's dress has been casualizing for hundreds of years. It's not even a 20th century kind of phenomenon. The suit itself was a more casual kind of garment compared to the frock coat. So in the early 20th century, a more formal gentleman would have worn a frock coat, and a kind of a clerk or administrator would wear a suit. So men's dress has been casualizing for a long time, but the Duke of Windsor essentially went, he had a famous tailor named Frederick Schulte, who was a Dutch-English tailor. And this tailor was famous for making something called the drape cut, which was a kind of like an extended shoulder, full chest, nipped waist cut. And it's a fantastic cut, and it's currently being carried forward by Anderson and Shepard. The founder of that tailoring house trained under Schulte. But Schulte was kind of a bit of an ill-tempered man. He had very, very strong views about style. He was very selective about who he would make clothes for. He believed that Hollywood stars, and I believe, yeah, he thought that Hollywood stars were not elegant enough for his clothes, so he refused to make clothes for most Hollywood stars. He, for example, in one time, a client came to him but arrived in a car that he thought was in bad taste, so he didn't accept the client. Another client was in his fitting room, and the wife had brought up that she thought that the coat could be improved in some way during the fitting, and he ripped the coat off of the client, threw it on the floor, and threw both of them out of the shop.
Yes! I love it! Love these kinds of characters.
He's Soup Nazi from Seinfeld, Dave, basically.
Suit Nazi.
Imagine being so confident in your clothes, though, that you just go, I'm not going to dress movie stars, rather than the opposite way we have now. I'm not going to dress them because they're not elegant enough to wear my clothes. So he I think it was right. Charles Hawtrey was one he made clothes for, but he wouldn't let him wear them on film.
Yeah, so he was a bit of an ill-tempered man with very strong views of clothes, and his most famous client, and certainly the most influential, was Edward VIII, who was the Duke of Windsor. But even the Duke of Windsor did not want to cross his tailor. He did not want to get on that tailor's bad side. But the Duke of Windsor had this thing where he was a bit of a rebel at the time. For example, he wore cuffs on his city suits, and his father, the King of England, had admonished him, said that this was kind of like in bad taste, and it was kind of too casual and too inappropriate for inspecting troops, but he did it anyway. So the Duke of Windsor wanted belts for his suits, and he didn't want to go to his normal tailor to get belted trousers because he knew he'd be thrown out of the shop, possibly lose his single source for clothes. So he went to a tailor in New York City. I believe it was H. Harris was the name of the tailor. And the Duke of Windsor's wife had made a joke saying that those were his pants from across the pond, because he would essentially get his coats from his English tailor and then his pants from an American tailor in New York City. And he wore belts with his suits and sport coats, and that started off a bit of a fashion. Again, whatever he wore, other men in high society followed, and then as other men in high society followed, the rest of society followed, because at least in the early part of the 20th century, that was still a kind of ruling dynamic, that people generally looked to the rich and powerful to see how they dress, and then they'd follow suit.
People will know him, if they're not up on their English monarchs, they will know him as being one of the most famous ones, Dave. If you've watched The Crown, he's the one that abdicated. So Wallace right. Simpson, and yes. You know, it caused a massive controversy at the time. But did he remain as influential after he left, or was this all, you know, when he was presumably Prince of Wales before he became king?
He was pretty influential for much of his entire life. He was considered kind of, I don't know if he was as influential after he abdicated the throne, but he was pretty influential for much of his life. I will say that for people who follow streetwear, for example, I would liken him to like Kanye West. Kanye West was incredibly influential for a time, and then he's recently fallen into some controversy and he's become much less influential. But he's still a pretty influential figure in terms of fashion. It is true that certain silhouettes and styles that he wears goes mainstream. And I would say the Duke of Windsor was sort of like that for tailored clothing. And he also had very controversial views and, you know, obviously abdicated the throne, was not terribly popular. But people still generally saw him as a fashionable figure, someone to emulate in terms of style.
Right. I was going to ask you, Derek, and you've kind of brought up Kanye there, but I was going to ask you, are there people today in society who can influence without being part of a fashion house or a fashion label and therefore, you know, dictating the trends for autumn, winter 24, 25 or whatever, you know, are there individuals today who can have an influence, you know, that can affect the rich and famous and then the rest of us who follow suit. You know, I'm trying to think, like, you know, is there anyone who holds that kind of power in today's society?
Yeah, it's become much more difficult. I would say Kanye is probably the last figure to have done that. And it's become much harder because over time, many of us have our lives are much more online. And on the internet, there is less gatekeeping. So, you know, if you think of in the 90s, a Vogue editor or a GQ editor would say, okay, well, this is the fashion. And designers would say, this is the fashion. And then they do all this press and, you know, these kind of magazines and people would follow. And then there were certain kind of figures like, you know, Richard Gere and so on and so forth who would popularize a certain look. Tom Selleck certainly popularized some looks. But now that everyone's online, people essentially can live in their own digital enclaves and they don't necessarily have to watch the same TV shows, pay attention to the same stars. They don't have to read the same fashion magazines. They may not read the same media. It's become much more difficult to shape fashion in that sense. So while you may have very popular figures in a very like cultural niche, you don't really have those big kind of changes anymore because we all live in different kind of cultural communities online.
We love a little bit of psychology on this show, Derek. And in case people are listening to this and feeling a little bit self-conscious about wearing something, particularly something new, I heard you delve into, and you've mentioned it before, the spotlight effect. Dave, you're going to love this. Can you explain what the spotlight effect was?
Yeah, so the spotlight effect comes from this brilliant American University study. It was at one of the Ivy League colleges, so like Harvard, Princeton, Yale, one of those. And essentially, this team of psychologists devised this experiment where they would hire undergrads to say, you know, we'll pay you whatever the amount was, like $20 if you come in for this experiment. And kids would sign up and then they tell them, let's all meet in this one room and we'll conduct this experiment. You'll get $20 for participating. All the students were told to go to this one room except for one student who was essentially the mark. And that student was given a different location. And when that student arrived to that location, there was another principal of that study there to meet them. And when that person arrived, the principal would say, we changed the location at the last minute. It's actually over at this other room. But in order to get the $20, you have to like race over there because you're running late at this point. But before you go, you have to put on this T-shirt. And the student would put on a T-shirt, and the T-shirt had a giant print of Barry Manilow's face. And the funny thing is in the academic paper that was eventually published, the authors stressed that Barry Manilow was a very embarrassing artist to young people at the time, which I thought was such an insult to Barry Manilow. I mean, for that to be like your academic legacy to be noted as hated by young people. So this student would put on a T-shirt of Barry Manilow's face, run to this other room, which is like the room that everyone else was told to go to. And then you have to imagine, you have to put yourself in the student's shoes, right? You're like, you're carrying this backpack, you got this Barry Manilow shirt on, you're running to this other room to get to this location. You open the door and they've arranged the seats in the classroom so that everyone is facing the door. So as soon as you open the door, you are just met with this like sea of young faces looking at you. And of course, everyone has already been seated. You've arrived 15 minutes late. So you're going in, trying to find an empty seat, taking off your backpack, sitting down. And by the time you sit down, the principal in that room says, you've arrived kind of late. I apologize. I just don't think you can participate in this study. We'll make some other arrangements, but you'll have to leave. So now you have to pick up your backpack, you know, slowly walk out of the room, and then you open the door, you exit. Once you exit, the third principal of the study is standing outside to greet you. And that principal asks you a series of questions. One of the questions is, how many people do you think in that room noticed your shirt? And that person would give some number, whatever, 70%, 80%, whatever. And then the other principal inside the room would poll the people in the class, how many people can name what was on that person's shirt? And then, you know, whatever the percentage was. In every run of this experiment, the person outside of the room overestimated how many people in the room noticed their quote-unquote stupid shirt.
Right.
And the spotlight effect The spotlight effect is essentially an idea in psychology that, one, that we are the main character of our own experience. We experience the world as the main character. So that's one. Two is that our emotions anchor how we read the world. So if I am running to a class, I'm wearing a shirt that I think is stupid and is, I think is embarrassing. I open the door, I see everyone looking at me, and then I'm already kind of feeling flustered. I don't feel good. I sit down and then I'm embarrassed that I have to get up and like pick up my backpack and walk away again. That emotion, I use that to anchor how I read other people. But in fact, everybody else in the room is their own main character, and their emotional anchoring is influencing how they read the room. So that person might be nervous about whatever, taking whatever they think is going to be the experiment. Another person might have spotted someone they think is attractive in the room, is focused on them, or whatever it is, right? Everyone is experiencing different emotions, and they're reading the room according to their own anchoring. So the spotlight effect is essentially that we always go through life thinking that we have the spotlight on us when often other people, you know, are living under their own spotlight. And it applies to clothes in the sense that I think when you're wearing something unusual that you're not used to wearing, in this case, maybe it's suspenders, it may be a stupid t-shirt, it may be a hat, you tend to think that people pay attention to it or they notice it or they put more value on it when really it's just your own kind of emotional anchoring.
Let me paint a little picture for both of you and for our audience, which is going back to 1997. I had spent the year in Russia, in St. Petersburg, as part of my university course. It was the summertime, and I was walking up the main pedestrianized shopping street here in Dublin, Derek. It's called Grafton Street. And I bumped into a college friend of mine who would pull no punches. Trust me, he's one of my good mates, still a great mate now. But he would let you know if he disagreed with what you were wearing, what, you know, how you smelled, whatever it was, he would just be straight up. So at that moment, I was wearing a pair of long, oversized Carl Kanai shorts, which any of our hip hop affiliated audience still know what that is. I am absolutely a white Irish guy. I need to say that. I've always worn Jordans, so I had a big pair of Jordans on. I had a navy and gold Yo MTV Raps basketball shirt on over an oversized white t-shirt. I had a chain on, because I'd come from Russia, with a two-headed eagle in the middle of the chain.
This sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, and I was wearing what I can only describe as Liam Gallagher hair in that prime mid-90s Oasis phase of brushed forward. So picture that for a second. So as you just explained, the spotlight effect, I think everyone's looking at me and judging me. They may or may not have been, but I met my mate Richie and he just tore into me there and then on the spot. He refused to be seen with me. He said, I was meeting him in town. This was what we were doing. We were hanging out for the day. And he left and he said, I am not hanging around with you. You look like, and I quote him, a fucking Egypt. And he just walked away. And to this day, he still recalls the day he met me in my basketball, hip hop, two-headed Russian phase.
We should explain to Derek, though, like that there are websites in Ireland dedicated to people who have slightly decided to wear one thing out of the ordinary in a small town and then mercilessly being ripped to shreds. You wear a beret once and then suddenly everyone's doing a French accent to you for the rest of your life. It's tall poppy syndrome.
I've seen those threads on Twitter, but I will say that outfit sounds awesome. I mean,
thank you. Yes, I thought so. Rad.
Yeah, that outfit sounds awesome, and people should definitely wear that even today. But I did read those threads on Twitter for both Ireland and I think it may have been Scotland, where someone would be in some town and a stranger would just like poke their head out and then make the funniest remark.
But the thing is, Dave, you talk about who sets the standards, and there's not so many celebrities that set the standards anymore. Derek was talking on a podcast I was listening to as part of the research for this, for this thing called good taste, and we call it capital G, capital T, and that's that sort of, I suppose you could describe royal families, Italian industrialists, the Kennedys, that sort of tailored wear that the upper echelons of society dressed like that, and because they were so influential, they passed it down. But there's also this idea of good taste with a small G and a small T, and that seems to be being stylish. And I think a lot of that is wearing something with elan, wearing something unusual. Somebody shouts something at you, you take it in good stead, but you're so confident and so happy, and you know enough about your own personal style that actually it's fine.
You're right. Okay.
You're rocking it.
Yeah, I think if you think of style as social and cultural language, it's much easier to answer the questions of how to put an outfit together, what colors go with what, does this work, does that work? Any kind of question that's related to an outfit, if you think of outfits as social and cultural language, it's much easier. So the ideas, the notions of good taste in the kind of capital G, capital T sense are essentially the taste of what was historically the ruling class. So Italian industrialists, you know, the American elites, the British royal family. So it'd be something like a brown tweed jacket with a light blue shirt, dark tie, gray trousers, dark brown shoes. Or it'd be a navy business suit with black Oxfords. If you understand that those things go together because they were associated with a class of people who held a lot of cultural capital, then it's much easier to understand how to put an outfit together, because you essentially think of clothes like a costume designer. You think of, if I'm dressing, you know, whoever's playing Prince Charles or the Duke of Windsor in the Netflix show The Crown, how do I put that outfit together? And then if you think like that, then you understand, oh, well, that's what's considered good taste. But there are many other forms of cultural taste. I mean, that is not the only legitimate taste. What we were talking about earlier of the Carl Kanai, you know, jeans with the Yo MTV rap shirt, I genuinely think that's a good outfit. And that demonstrates a different type of cultural taste. That outfit would look different if you wore, I don't know, let's say a Carl Kanai pair of jeans with a Shetland sweater or, you know, something like, there are certain combinations that would just not make any sense. But Carl Kanai jeans with Jordans and a Yo MTV, you know, t-shirt is perfect. That makes cultural sense. And I think of that as stylish.
Well, then I'm going to clip this little bit of this podcast and send it to my mate Richie and explain to him that I was just merely ahead of the curve. And I was, as Neil said, rocking it.
I would point out that Richie did have the example of seeing your head in that outfit, though.
True,
and
true.
Derek, it hasn't seen your head, and
he
I think
has a
your head is a
image.
Game changer in this day. Absolutely. Derek, I feel like anybody who follows you on Twitter will go mad at me if I don't ask you for specific style tips. Now, listen, we're on an audio medium, so it can be difficult in some ways. But I mean, there are certain things that you advise on, I think, that people will find helpful. So you give some great tips about fit. Say I have a sweater. It's the only time I'm ever going to say sweater and not jumper. That is a particularly good fit. How do I measure it so I can get similar ones in future? What are the three measurements I would need?
So if you already have a sweater that you like at home, just lay it flat on your bed or a table, and then take a flexible measuring tape and measure it from pit to pit, which is armpit to armpit, and that's your chest measurement. So for a size small, that might be, or either a size small or a size 38 chest, you probably are going to be somewhere around 21 inches from pit to pit. And then flip the sweater around and then measure it from shoulder seam to shoulder seam across the top. And that will be your shoulder measurement. And then finally, you want to measure from the, on every garment, you're going to find the collar attached to the body of the garment. And you want to stretch the measuring tape from the bottom seam of that collar all the way down to the hem, and that's your length. The reason why you don't want to stretch it to the top of the collar is sometimes, depending on the design of the garment, the collar can be very big. So you want to stretch it from the bottom of the collar down to the hem, and now essentially those three measurements, chest, shoulder, and length, will give you a pretty good sense of whether, when you're shopping online, whether something's going to fit you.
When I buy a suit a sports coat, I suppose, what should I look for fit-wise in the jacket?
So for suits and sport coats, I strongly advise buying in person, if you can, because suits and sport coats are much harder to alter than other types of garments. So when you're trying on a suit jacket or sport coat, the important thing to understand is that the jacket is made from many layers of haircloth padding, pad stitching, canvas. So there's a lot of construction that's gone on to into the garment. And that will determine what you can alter. So when you're putting on that jacket, there are a couple of things to look for. One is, does it feel comfortable in the chest and shoulders? So when you fasten the jacket, kind of like move around and see if, you know, if you can hug someone essentially. Two is, as you're moving around, I mean, you know, like normal movements, not like you're, don't act like you're swimming through a swimming pool, but in normal movements that you would do in daily life, do that in front of the mirror and watch the collar of the jacket. The collar of the jacket is the part that touches your neck. If the collar of your jacket is lifting off of your neck, the jacket is not good for you. The collar should always hug your neck. That's the second thing. And the third thing is the length. Many jackets nowadays are very, very short. And I think many men look better in a jacket where the hem of the jacket bisects you halfway from the collar to the floor when you're wearing heeled shoes. So take a step back from the mirror and just take a look at yourself and try to see if the upper and lower halves of your outfit are roughly equal. If the jacket is very, very short, it often just can kind of make you look a bit heavy. It doesn't look very flattering. The buttoning point ends up going up closer to your sternum, so it doesn't give you that flattering kind of like V-shaped figure. So those three things, just make sure it fits in the shoulders and chest, because those are going to be very, very hard to alter because of all the construction that goes into it. Make sure that the collar always hugs your neck, and make sure the length is about right, because you cannot really lengthen a ready-to-wear jacket. The other things that when you're looking in the mirror, many of the other things can be changed. So for example, depending on the specifics, most of the times the sleeves can be taken up. It's very easy to nip the waist. So if you feel the waist is a bit baggy, you can just take it to a tailoring shop. They'll nip the waist a little to make it a little bit trimmer. Many of the other things can be fixed, but the chest, collar, and length are not things that you can easily alter. So you want to make sure those look right from the beginning.
And Derek, if the collar, as you said, if the collar isn't staying on your neck, does that mean the jacket is too big or too small?
There are many things that can cause that. So it's hard to diagnose generally, right. But it can be caused because the chest is too small. When the chest is too small, the jacket is essentially exploding off of you. So the collar will lift off your neck then. It could also be that the jacket's shoulder is not cut correctly for the slope of your shoulder. So if you have very sloped or very square shoulders and the jacket is not cut correctly for that slope, the collar can lift off your neck. Sometimes it could be that the shoulders are too narrow. That can also cause the collar to not sit right. There are many different things. It's hard to diagnose, but the important thing to note is that for a ready-to-wear jacket, that's going to be often hard to fix. And if it is fixable, it will be expensive. So the easier thing when you see the collar kind of jumping off of your neck all the time is to just then move off to try a different model. I will say that you have some common sense about it, right? Like if you are trying on a jacket, first off, you have to have a collared shirt to try this. So you're in a shop, make sure you have a dress shirt essentially. Try on the jacket and see if the collar is always hugging your dress shirt. But you know, like if you see a little bit of movement, it's not that big of a deal. When the jacket is like gaping off of your neck, and you know, as you're moving your arms, you just see the jacket lifting off of you and all that, and it's fighting against you, it's not a good fit for you. So it would be easier to try on a different jacket.
Dave, I'll take your largely basketball, hip-hop inspired outfit and go one better. Now, I had an excuse to wear it, but high-waisted trousers. Never worn high-waisted trousers before. High-waisted trousers, Dave. Black. Derek, I want you to assess this outfit, right? Short, bedazzled bolero jacket. Right?
Yes.
And Cuban heels, Dave. And
awesome.
I looked tremendous. Now, I was doing Dancing with the Stars and opening the entire series with a Paso Doble.
You were.
Do you actually own Cuban heel shoes?
No, I don't, but you have to wear them for certain dances. You wear Cuban heels for all the Latin dances in Dancing with the Stars on TV.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love those shoes.
Oh my God. Well, listen, the high-waisted trouser, I wasn't a fan, and then I wore them and I was a fan, Derek. I mean, I was completely convinced. I was completely converted to that side of the fence. Can I ask you, so we started this with Dave, basically the King of England has influenced what's holding up your trousers. Although I didn't take into account your your short wearing habit. Should you ever see the actual suspenders and or should you not see the suspenders? And secondly, it's a two-part question. When you close a jacket, a formal sort of jacket, should you see the shirt under the fastening, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, so to both those questions, the first answer is no. You should not see the suspenders. Suspenders should be really relegated to tailored clothing, so meaning suits, sport coats, and tailored trousers. And you know, you can choose suspenders depending on your outfit. So a very common way to choose suspenders is to make sure that the leather kips, which are the kind of like leather bits at the bottom, match your shoes. So if you're wearing black shoes, you want black leather kips. If you're wearing brown shoes, you want brown leather kips. And in the winter, you can wear box cloth. In the summer, you can wear silk or grosgrain. You know, you can maybe choose a color that, you know, kind of complements the rest of your outfit. But generally speaking, those suspenders are always underneath your jacket and they're never really seen. I mean, they're kind of seen because you're moving throughout the day. You might unbutton your jacket and someone might notice you're wearing suspenders. But I generally don't think that you should wear suspenders, one, without a tailored jacket, and two, as kind of like a style accessory. I don't think you should wear them with jeans. I don't think you should wear them with low-waisted trousers, because then it gets, for me, it becomes a little kitschy and it becomes a little bit too kind of like 1940s speakeasy bartender. And then for the other question about when you're fastening a jacket, the fastening point is either the top button on a two-button coat or the center button on a three-button coat. So when you're fastening that fastening point, you want to look in the mirror and make sure that you generally cannot see any shirt peeking out from beneath the buttoning point. And that is achieved by good tailoring on the jacket as well as high-waisted trousers. Those are two things that contribute to that. And the reason why you don't want any shirt to peek through is because it breaks up the visual harmony of the ensemble. So it's easiest to demonstrate this if you think of it, if you look online, it really there are tons of pictures online, but if you think in your mind, a navy suit with a white shirt and you're fastening the fastening point, the navy suit looks best when it's just a continuous kind of like navy outfit and then accented by that triangle of white shirt, dark tie, and then the jacket's kind of fronts. It breaks up the harmony if all of a sudden you're looking at this otherwise beautifully tailored outfit and then you see this like flash of shirt triangle beneath the buttoning point and these low-waisted trousers. But getting that right requires good tailoring. And two, I would say that, you know, once again, these are kind of general ideas. I don't think anyone should be, they should, how should I put this? They should aid in your enjoyment of the clothes. So if you see a little bit of shirt peeking out in an otherwise beautiful outfit, I don't think you should get, you know, kind of like hung up on it. The idea is to just create a more beautiful outfit and to enjoy what you're wearing.
Well, Derek, we could talk to you all day about these things. I mean, Dave, we didn't even get into, which I didn't really realize, didn't think about the great male renunciation, in that we were kind of allowed in some ways to wear kind of more flamboyant clothes. And then after the Reformation, there was a shall we say, oh, okay, we're going to allow women to do that. And it's more frivolous and that's frippery and we're men of science and learning and we should be a bit more dour. I hadn't come across that until I started researching this, and Derek talks very eloquently about that elsewhere. And he also talks, and you people should look this up, is about the effect of the Oscar Wilde libel trial on fashion. And of course, that's Oscar Wilde and Edward Carson. Edward Carson was the man who was on the other side, the founder of unionism in Northern Ireland. You can look that up as well. Two Irishmen had an indirect and direct effect on what people think of what is fashionable and what is not to be worn, because it's very flamboyant and
interesting
cues of that sort of stuff. It's been an absolute pleasure. You can follow Derek online. He's absolutely massive on Twitter. I suggest you in particular look up where he's talking about the King of Spain's clothes, because it goes into such detail and it's really, really interesting. Derek Guy, thanks a million for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to part three of Why Would You Tell Me That? Well, Dave, so the King of England, King Edward VIII, basically had such an impact on fashion that this is why a lot of people wear belts today.
I I feel better dressed just for having talked to Derek Guy, even though I'm still in shorts and a t-shirt. I still feel better dressed.
Yeah, now at least I know what I'm doing wrong. And I mean, I won't take any corrective action in any way, shape or form. But no. If we both chose to, we would know what to do.
Exactly. If we wanted to appear unbelievably stylish in the French Riviera or at the Met Gala or something like that, we absolutely could. However, you'll probably find us both in Eurospar in a pair of tracksuit bottoms.
Absolutely, yeah. And when we say in a pair of tracksuit bottoms, we actually mean the one pair. Yeah. It's weird now. We both get into a leg each. That's how close we've grown over.
We hop podcast. In a beautifully timed, synchronous orbit of each other. It's fabulous.
I mean, it's beautiful. It's like the moon just orbiting the Earth. We will leave that image there. David, what do you have for us next week?
Oh, next week, I'm genuinely going to blow everyone's mind next week because I want to introduce you to the man who wants to organize the world's worst football tournament and tell you why it would be absolutely brilliant.
Oh, that's class.
Yep.
That's absolutely class. Okay, I can't wait for that.
We'll get to that next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.